Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. For those interested, we are offering a free sample PDF of the March-April issue and a sample print issue of the Barnes Review. But if you want to fully subscribe to our magazine, visit our website, barnesreview.com. The website is your one-stop shop for revisionist history, which boasts a selection of over 400 revisionist history books. To take advantage of any of these offers, visit barnesreview.com, email sales@barnesreview.org, or call toll-free 1-877-773-9077, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 4 Eastern Time. To get your sample print issue of the Barnes Review, send a $5 postage to the Barnes Review at P.O. Box 550 White Plains, Maryland 20695. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Barnes Review History Hour, your home for fearless historical inquiry. This is your host again, Jose Nino. And this evening, I have on J. Otto Pohl, a distinguished historian and academic researcher whose work generally focuses on ethnic minorities in the Soviet Union. How are you doing today, Otto?
Good.
I found your background to be quite fascinating. And before we start talking about Soviet history, can you give the audience a brief rundown of your work?
Well, I have four books. One of them's kind of only semi-academic, but the other three are scholarly. So in 1997, the Stalinist penal system on Soviet labor camps, kind of a structural history of Gulag and adjacent punitive institutions. A second book in 1999, Ethnic Cleansing in the USSR, 1937 to 1949, is a rundown of the major ethnic groups deported in their almost entirety or large numbers, plurality, into Siberia and Central Asia and Kazakhstan as special settlers. So starts in 37 with the Koreans, who are deported as administrative exiles, not special settlers, but then the Germans in 41 and the Finns in 41, then various North Caucasian peoples in 1943 and 1944, Kalmucks in 43 and the Crimean Tatars in 44. And my latest book, well, I did a kind of semi-popular book. It's kind of short, like 100 pages, published by American Historical Society of Germans from Russia, basically on the history of ethnic Germans in the Soviet Union, called Catherine's Grandchildren. So that one is not, it doesn't have footnotes. It has instead an annotated bibliography at the end. But my latest book was 2022, Verlag in Stuttgart. It's Years of Great Silence, and it's specifically a history of ethnic Germans in the Russian Empire and Soviet Union, with an emphasis on the 14 years between 1941 and 1955, when they were under special settlement restrictions in Kazakhstan and Siberia. So it's called the Years of Great Silence because they weren't allowed to talk about it until glasnost and perestroika near the end of the Soviet era. And so this book had been out now 3 years, but it took me probably, counting everything, about 10 years to research and put together, the final part being pretty fast of writing it during COVID at night and getting a publisher for it. But it is I would say certainly my most heavily researched and best work. And it had a very good review in Slavic Review by Petri Ahonen out of Finland, who was a retired professor who deals with ethnic Finns in the Soviet Union. That's available on the internet. I think that's the only actual academic journal that's reviewed it so far, but it was a very positive and favorable review. But there's been some other reviews. Josh Neal, whom I did a show with this morning, has a review on his Substack that's also very complimentary. And Josh Neal, while he is also an exile from academia, is one of the better minds out there writing nonfiction at this moment.
So I'm genuinely curious about this because in our latest issue of the Barnes Review, the upcoming May-June issue, we have one author who I believe you may know of, Matthew Raphael Johnson, who has a piece titled Communist Misrule in Soviet Kazakhstan. So what was like the Soviet Union's policies towards the ethnic minorities across the Soviet Union, like say from like the 1920s up until World War II?
It varies depending on what the class of minorities are in and exactly which time period we're talking about. So there are a couple of things going on. The first thing is when the Russian Empire falls apart, in the Civil War, there's the whites who are want to bring back the old order from the Tsarist times, and the Bolsheviks, the Reds, and then there's the peasant movements, the Greens, but an anarchist who are the blacks under Makhno. But there's also a whole bunch of non-Russian nationalities seeking greater autonomy or independence. In some cases, the Estonian, the Latvian, the Lithuanian, and certainly the Finns and the Poles, they are successful in getting independent. Others, the Ukrainian, the Georgians, Azerbaijanis, Armenian, get it for a brief time, about in 1918 to 1921, and then they're crushed by the Red Army and incorporated into the USSR, which is formally created at the end of 1921. So what happens after this is that the Bolsheviks, or during it, come to the conclusion that one of the reasons they almost lost the Civil War was because the opposition of all these non-Russian nationalities. And they were over 50% of the population of the Russian Empire. They're about 49% of the population of the Soviet Union because Finland, the Baltic states, and particularly Poland remove a lot of people from the Soviet Union that had been part of the Russian Empire. So they start to make concessions. Most notably, they give kind of pseudo-proto states that are allowed to support the various non-Russian nationalities' language and create a socialist culture, the idea of national in form and socialist in content. And actually, the first such territory is the Volga German Workers' Commune. It was founded by Lenin on 19th of October, 1918. The second such territory is with the Bashkirs, who are Turkic Muslim people in the Urals. But basically, almost all of the nationalities, even diaspora nationalities, get some sort of autonomy in these little territories. It can be only, sometimes they just have little districts or rayoni. So like there's some Greek rayoni in the Caucasus in Ukraine. There's a Korean one in Posets near Vladivostok. There are a number of German ones, particularly in Ukraine, but also one in Georgia and one in Azerbaijan, and some in Russia itself. There are a couple of Jewish ones, one in Crimea, and the Jewish Autonomous Oblast. But generally, their go-to nationalities that were indigenous to the Russian Empire. So Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, the Georgian Soviet Socialist Republic, the Uzbek Soviet Socialist Republic, and then the next level, the Autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic. So within the RSFSR, there was a Kazakh ASSR until 1936 when it became a full-fledged republic. Same thing with Kyrgyzstan. There's a Buryat Autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic. The German Autonomous Workers' Commune becomes an Autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic in 1924. It's upgraded. And so there's kind of a hierarchy. So you have the full republics, then you have the autonomous republics, then you have oblast, and then you have lowest level of actual territory, really the districts we own, but even smaller actual Soviets, and below that, even kolkhozes or collective farm organized on the basis of the Soviet Russian term is nationalnost. It's really a racialized ethnicity, and that it's inherited biologically from your parents and your ancestors, but it basically defined culturally, particularly ancestral language. So this is how they define groups of being German or Uzbek or Ukrainian. And so interestingly enough, for the Jews, the initial definition is people descended of Yiddish speakers, and the non-Yiddish speaking Jews, the Persian speaking Bukharan Jews in Uzbekistan, are classified as a separate nationality from the Ashkenazis, who are Yiddish speaking heritage. And so you have this hierarchy. But as time goes on, obviously the social economic basis of many of these nationalities is incompatible with Soviet economic socialist development. And so a lot of them get ruthlessly repressed during collectivization of agriculture and subsequent famines and industrialization. The most hard hit as far as famine deaths are the Kazakhs, who are mostly semi-nomadic, transhumanist. They have a winter pasture and a summer pasture, and then about 10% were totally nomadic. But in order to collectivize agriculture, they had to be forcibly settled. And of course, the land in Kazakhstan was not capable of supporting their livestock year-round. They had to move it from one pasture to another at least once every 6 months or so. And so they run out of food, and then they eat all the livestock, and now there's no food and a massive starvation. And estimates are perhaps as many as 50 to 60% of the ethnic Kazakh population dies between 1930 and 1934 from hunger-related causes. The second most hard hit by famines in the early 30s are the Volga Germans. So very prosperous historically. There was one famine under the Tsars, 1891-1892. There's another famine in 1921-1922 because of the Bolsheviks taking all the food out in forced requisitions. But the forced collectivization really destroys agricultural output of particularly wheat and livestock, and about 20% of the population of the Volga German ASSR, which is over two-thirds German, they all perish at this time from famine. It's a big issue in Germany itself. National socialist activists like Adolf Erich, who was known for his work on writing about communist insurgencies in the interwar period, he writes a brochure called Bruder in Not, or Brother in Need. Hans Steinacher, who was Austrian. Erich is, by the way, a Volga German. He's from Saratov. He migrates during the Civil War, along with about 120,000 other Germans fleeing communism into Germany, and about half stay. But Steinacher is from Austria, but he's also involved in raising awareness about the famine. It's particularly when the hardest hit, the year 1933, which is the year Hitler is appointed chancellor by Hindenburg, in March, and you start to see a lot of articles about Steinacher and around August of 1933.
One thing that's struck out to me in what you mentioned with regards to the ethnic policy is the omission of the Russian ethnic group. What were the Soviets' initial policies towards ethnic Russians? Were those policies designed to undermine their political and social standing?
Okay, so again, it changes. So, well, I'll take them both here. So as we get up past into the 40s. But initially, part of this giving every nationality its own territory and promoting their cultural in a socialist manner, particularly their language for education and publications, newspapers, books, radio, theater, film even. The Kurdish-speaking minority in Armenia, the first Kurdish language movie was produced in the Armenian Soviet Socialist Republic, as was the first Kurdish language novel. So there's all this, money being poured into the cultural infrastructure. But the Russians have what's left. So the RSFSR isn't a full republic like Ukraine or Uzbekistan. It's a federation of its own with all these autonomous Soviet socialist republics and smaller ethnic territories in it. And so the Russian part is the negative space after we remove all of it. And so they don't have the official institutions that these other nationalities have. They kind of are asked to identify with the USSR as a whole because for practical reasons, Russian is the official language of the state, especially for the military and the administration in Moscow. There is also a policy of opposing what they call great power chauvinism, which is opposition to Russian nationalism. So this policy is enforced up in the 20s, and particularly, the early Soviet government, it's not that Russian. So the first Politburo, the only Russians in it are Bubanov, who's full-blooded Russian, and then Lenin, who is classified as Russian, but he's only a quarter by blood. So he's a quarter Swedish Volga German. I'm not sure if that has anything to do with him creating the Volga German Workers' Commune or not. He's a quarter Jewish, and he's a quarter Kalmuk. All right, so if we count him, we have two Russians out of seven in the first Politburo. Then we have Stalin, who is Georgian, and then we have four Jewish guys, Trotsky, Kamenev, Zinoviev, and Sokolnikov. And all the way up until 1926, when Stalin gets Trotsky, Kamenev, and Zinoviev out, the ruling Politburo of the Soviet Union is between 40% and 60% Jewish, even though they are only 2% of the population. There is also a lot of Latvians in the early Soviet government, particularly in the Chekhov. They basically faded by 1923-1924. With the rise of Yagoda as number two man in the GPU and OGPU under Mendzinski, who was Polish. Came after Dzerzhinsky, who was also Polish. And you see a lot of Jews coming into the OGPU leadership and NKVD leadership because they are in this kind of geographical ethnic circle around Yagoda. So the first head of the Chekhov, Dzerzhinsky is Polish, the second Mendzinski is Polish, the third, the head of the NKVD, Yagoda is Jewish, the fourth, Yezhov is half Russian, half Lithuanian. But geographically, they're all from the Pale of Settlement, which was the old Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And when Beria comes to power in the end of 1938, he purges most of these people, brings his own people in, mostly from more southern regions, so we get a lot more Georgians, we get a lot more ethnic Armenians from Georgia, we get a lot more Russians and Ukrainians, and the Jewish portion of the leadership of the NKVD, which reached its peak in 1934 under Yagoda at almost 40%, it goes from 20% in 38 during the the height of the purges down to 4%, because these people were associated with Yagoda and Yezhov, and Beria is removing them to put his own people in. And at this point, around 1936 to 1938, during the Great Terror, that you start to see the rehabilitation of the Russian nation, largely because Stalin is a Georgian, but he realizes you can't run an empire that's over 50% ethnically Russian from just minorities, right? You can't have minorities that are 2% of the population controlling everything. So they have the first praising of the Russian nation ever in Soviet newspapers. There's two articles printed in Pravda in 36, and the new Soviet constitution written by Bukharin, who was an ethnic Russian, although he'll later be purged by Stalin, is promulgated. And you see this also diaspora nationalities, particularly from Europe, although to a lesser extent from Asia, starting to be targeted because it is believed that not only their culture is tied to states outside of the Soviet Union, but also their political loyalties ultimately. So this, you see, there's a massive operations against ethnic Poles, ethnic Germans, ethnic Latvians. The first mass deportation is of Koreans in the Far East into Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan in 37. Greeks are targeted, Finns, Estonians. The only diaspora groups that are not targeted are those that don't have a homeland outside of the Soviet Union. So Jews, Gypsies, Assyrians are about the only three groups of any numbers, significant numbers, that avoid this terror. So, but of the 1.5 million people arrested in 37, 38 by the NKVD, 700,000 are shot, and about 800,000 sent to labor camps. But of those shot, 250,000 are from these diaspora nationalities, or 1.7% of the population of the Soviet Union. And then there's another 100,000 or so sent to labor camps. So the largest in absolute numbers and percentage are ethnic Poles in Ukraine and Belarus. Boris Berman is the head of the NKVD in Belarus, and Israel Leplevsky is the head of the NKVD in Ukraine till he's replaced with Alexander Uspensky. So you still see the high-ranking Jewish contingent there in the Republican level in 1937 and 1938. So they're going after ethnic Poles because Poland is a hostile power to the Soviet Union. They go after the Germans, the next largest group hit in terms of absolute numbers. You have something like 72,000 Germans arrested, about 5% of the total population, and 46,000 of them executed. A lot of them, about 38,000 arrests and 29,000 of the executions in a specific German operation. Most of the rest, about 21,000 or so, are under Kulak operation. But in 1930, 1931, there's already a large conflation of kulaks, of Germans being kulaks, also Poles as well. We have this in the Soviet documents and the archives of many of the people carrying out dekulakization, in particularly Ukraine, that all the Poles and all the Germans are in fact kulaks regardless of their economic status. So it becomes ethnicized. And in 37, 38, of course, they go hard against the elites, the more educated sectors of the diaspora nationalities, the Poles, the Germans, the Latvians, the Greeks. And then during the war, there's a mass deportation. So in 1941, almost all of the ethnic Germans that are not rescued by the Wehrmacht in the Soviet Union west of the Urals are deported into either Siberia or Kazakhstan. It's about half and half. And the Volga Germans, about 75% to Siberia and a quarter to Kazakhstan for those outside the Volga and eastern Ukraine and the Caucasus and Moscow, etc. Mostly about three quarters to Kazakhstan and a quarter to Siberia.
With respect to the famines of the 1930s, what exactly caused those catastrophes?
Well, in the case of the Kazakhs, as I said, it was the forced settlement of nomadic and semi-nomadic pastoralists on land that was not capable of supporting livestock year-round. And this was obviously known. I mean, but it was a deliberate policy for the Soviets to collectivize agriculture and settle the population for political control. So they weren't real concerned. The head of the Communist Party in Kazakhstan, Philip Golishkin, was another Jewish Bolshevik. He was actually involved with the assassination of the Tsar. And in Ukraine and in the Volga German ASSR, the populations were already sedentary and were obviously successful in growing food, particularly wheat. But what happened was in Ukraine, after collectivization, the food is removed. So they send down a 25,000, basically Communist Party activists, to forcibly remove food from the farms. They are still exporting grain to Europe at this time for hard currency, for industrialization. But in one sense, it's basically a massive transfer of agricultural wealth where the majority of the population lives to the cities in order to industrialize and urbanize them to benefit the class that's supposed to be ruling the Soviet Union, the urban proletariat. And this, of course, happens to be, in terms of numeric, mostly Russian, but there are some minorities that are heavily urbanized and living in cities like Moscow and Leningrad as well. The Jewish minority, as I said, they're still prominent in the political police at this time under Yagoda, is another group that largely avoids the massive suffering. But for rural groups like the ethnic Germans and the Volga in Ukraine, most Ukrainians, the Kazakhs are separate, but certainly suffered from famine at this time. The Polish population, again, mostly rural in Ukraine and Belarus, they have very high fatality rates. Overall, Ukraine as a whole, about 3.8 million people died, is about 13% of the total population. Volga German ASSR, it's higher at 20%. So it was a way to impose political and economic control over the countryside, particularly over rural populations that had not been, that were not Sovietizing very fast. They were remaining national in content rather than socialist.
I'm listening to this with fascination because I was obviously more aware of the Ukrainian famine situation because of the Holodomor, and I have vaguely heard about the Kazakh case. The Volga German case, though, is something that I just learned about in this conversation. And why do you believe that the Ukrainian case receives much more attention as opposed to, say, like the Volga or the Kazakh famines?
Because they have a much better organized and louder diaspora in the United States and Canada.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, and would you say that the Ukrainian, SSR was like the one that was like the least Sovietized of all the SSRs?
Yeah. Ukraine, you make a good example that the collectivization and dekulakization followed by taking all the food out and crushing the peasantry through this famine, the Holodomor, accelerated, at least in eastern Ukraine. Western Ukraine was under Polish rule at the time, Sovietization. But an argument could also be made that it did the same in Kazakhstan. The Kazakhs are the most Sovietized of the Central Asian peoples. In many ways, they're very similar to the Kyrgyz, but the Kyrgyz, they managed to maintain nomadism all the way through the Soviet era, a kind of underground, particularly around Lake Issyk-Kul, is a big salt lake in the east part. And ironically, what destroyed nomadism in Kyrgyzstan was the importation of cheap meat from China after the Soviet Union had collapsed. They couldn't compete with capitalism. But certainly with the Soviet-style socialism that crushed nomadic way of life in Kazakhstan and brought them into a urban industrial way of life that, while officially Soviet, right, you can see that it's coming from Russian roots. So there's some other things in there as well, obviously, but certainly not something indigenous to nomadic steppe people.
The case of the Koreans also caught my attention as well. What prompted their mass deportation from the Far East?
Okay, so there were about 172,000 ethnic Koreans that were deported in the fall of 1937 from the Russian Far East to Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. The official justification by the Soviet government was to prevent the Japanese from sending Koreans from the Japanese Empire into the Soviet Far East that could blend in, use the Korean population, Soviet Union as a cover, right? They could hide amongst them. But if they remove all of the Korean diaspora, there's no cover for them. So they moved all the ethnic Koreans into Central Asia, and they expelled those that they didn't send to camps, or actually all the ethnic Chinese from the Far East. So east of Lake Baikal became almost completely Russian and Ukrainian and other European nationalities, and these Asian diasporas that had migrated fairly recently. The Koreans start migrating in the late 19th century from Northern Korea and Manchuria, largely to flee their own repressive landlords, but also there's famine in Korea. And then when the Japanese take it in 1905 as a protectorate, and then annex it as a colony in 1910. A lot leave various repressions by the Japanese. They flee into the Soviet Union. So they're coming in all the way up until about 1932, when the Soviets finally managed to close the border. And they, the Soviets were never really enthusiastic about having a large Korean population there, in part because of the fact that the Korea was outside of the Russian Empire, Soviet Union, so they didn't trust the Koreans, thought perhaps it would be a springboard for conflict with Japan. Many of the Koreans, of course, during the Civil War had fought with the Bolsheviks, but they were also intently opposed to Japanese rule over their homeland. But there was also the idea that the Koreans, being racially different as well as ethnically different, could never be assimilated into a kind of Russian-based Soviet people. And so there was no way to actually absorb the population. So it was necessary to have them, as it were, geographically isolated away from the border, geographically isolated away from areas that were strategic and vulnerable to a foreign attack, in this case, particularly the Japanese, but also various events in Manchuria and China. And in 37 is after the sale in 36 of the Chinese Eastern Railroad to the Japanese. So the Soviets are trying to consolidate their position in the Far East, largely against the Japanese, but also they're withdrawing from Manchuria. So they, when they sell the railroad, they take back most of the workers, the Harbinites, and these people are also have a national operation against them. They're arrested and sent to labor camps or executed because they had been outside of the Soviet Union. I knew one Harbinite in Bishkek. He was not smart enough to stay, and a young man at the time returned to the Soviet Union and ended up spending 10 years in a labor camp. Lucky that he was not shot. But this was kind of the paranoid xenophobia against anything that was foreign. including basically Soviet Russians that had been outside of the Soviet Union too long.
Now, going to the Jewish population in the Soviet Union, were the Jews in the Soviet Union more Bolshevistic and communistic, or were they more leaning towards Zionism?
Oh, well, yeah, they were more with the old Bolsheviks. So you look at the highest ranking Jews in the Soviet government, and they were there from 1917, the first Politburo, all the way till 1926 as a kind of core, you know, at least 40%. This is Trotsky, Kamenev, and Zinoviev. But they get split amongst each other. But basically, long term, if you want to look at the Politburo kind of ethnic factions, there's like three. So, and the internationalist Jewish faction, particularly Trotsky, and there's kind of the moderate Russian faction, Bukharin in particular, but also Tomsky and Ryutin. So Trotsky, Kamenev, and Zinoviev are called the left opposition. Bukharin, Ryutin, Tomsky are the right opposition. And then you have Stalin with Georgian and Beria around him at Georgian, but some other people, different nationalities as well. Molotov is Russian. Kaganovich is Jewish. Mikoyan is Armenian. These are all close associates to Stalin. So Stalin, in 1926, removes Trotsky, Kamenev, and Zinoviev. Trotsky ends up being exiled to Kazakhstan and then expelled from the Soviet Union. He's in Turkey and Norway and finally Mexico before he's assassinated by the NKVD in 1940. Kamenev and Zinoviev were tried and executed in the Soviet Union in 1936. So after this, you don't have this powerful Jewish faction in the Politburo anymore. The Politburo basically becomes Stalin and his henchmen. But you do have, of course, one very powerful Jew who is a very loyal henchman of Stalin, appointed in 1930, Lazar Moisevich Kaganovich. And he will be, depending on how you look at it, but in the very top ranks of Soviet power all the way till 1957, when he's removed from power. He's not executed. He lives to 91, just before the Soviet Union collapsed. And he was interviewed by a Russian journalist not too long before he died in his 90s. I think he was 97. Felix Chuev interviewed him, and he said, "I only regret we were too soft. We didn't kill enough people. We weren't harsh enough. Otherwise, the Soviet Union wouldn't be collapsing." He had no regrets or remorse whatsoever. But one of the most brutal figures in a very brutal history of the Soviet Union. So he was the one. He was one of the people that Stalin sent to remove food from Ukraine during the Holodomor. He was the one that was in charge of the deportation trains for the Volga Germans, the Crimean Tatars. He was the one that was in charge of building the Moscow subway with German prisoners of war captured from the Wehrmacht. He was the one that was in charge of railroad construction using forced labor of Volga Germans and Black Sea Germans during the war. So he had a huge list of crimes that if he had been put up in Nuremberg, right, you know, you just could read the like first page and he'd be ready to hang him. But he was never charged or tried with anything and died peacefully in Moscow at age 97.
Wow. Interesting. With respect to the state of Israel, from what I've gathered of like the Soviet Union's position, it was that it was actually kind of nuanced where it initially supported the formation of it, but then ended up opposing it. What generated this change in policy towards Israel among the Soviets?
The first thing is the removal of the so-called left faction and right faction, so by Stalin and consolidation. So for the left faction, a lot of what problems with Trotsky's was his idea of permanent revolution. That is, that you have to have communism successful in places like Germany and Great Britain, and then the new communist Germany will come in and help build the Soviet Union, which is kind of a really fantastical idea when you think about it, right? You're going to depend on a foreign country for your development. And they run into trouble. In 1927, which is already after Trotsky's removed, there's a Shanghai uprising, the total failure to try and emulate the Bolshevik Revolution in China. And so Stalin, as the secretary of the Communist Party, secretary general, he appointed the people who elected the Central Committee, and the Central Committee then elects the Politburo. So he basically controlled the personnel, and this is how he was able to consolidate power and get rid of his opponent. At this point, they decided to jettison this idea of world revolution first and then Soviet industrialization. That is, they were going to have socialism in one country. They're going to use the resources of the Soviet Union itself, which is why you basically have mass extraction of the wealth and large numbers of death from the countryside to industrialize the cities at this time. The first five-year plan starting in 1928, and it's finished in 1932, 4 years, and then the second five-year plan, 1932 to 1937. And the third one, 37, is not completed because of the German invasion in 41. But this is a massive industrialization of infrastructure using large amounts of slave labor. Gulag, the head of the Gulag, doing the most important part of this is Matvey Berman, who's the brother of Boris Berman. He's head of the Gulag from 1932 to 1937. He takes over from Lazar Kogan, who had been head of it earlier. And then after Berman, Jew, Israel Plinner, during 1938. So this is a time of massive infrastructure projects using prisoners, the White Sea-Baltic Canal, the most famous one, but also Baikal and Amur mainline, the railroad in the Far East, coal cities built, Magnitogorsk and the Urals. There is a massive building of canals and roads and railroads and factories, mostly for the production of armament and the production of industrial goods. They never got to the five-year plan that would concentrate on consumer goods.
That's interesting. Okay. There's one point that I've also found really shocking over the last 2 years that I've delved more into revisionist narratives about World War II in particular, because there's obviously the fixation with court historians on the Holocaust and the National Socialist Germany's policies towards its Jewish population and also of like the territories that were under its control in World War II. However, one of like the more shocking things that is largely overlooked is the forced displacement of Germans throughout World War II and the immediate years in the conclusion of the conflict. Based on your research, how many Germans were displaced by the Soviets in that period?
Yeah, okay. So the initial deportation, it's a little under 800,000, because they weren't able to deport everybody. Central and Western Ukraine, about 300,000 Germans were saved from deportation by the Wehrmacht in 1941. So in the time period, the Volga Germans are deported 3rd to 20th of September. They're about 450,000. And then you have another 300,000 or so deported from other parts of the Soviet Union, the Northern Caucasus, Crimea, Eastern Ukraine, etc. To those that are added, there's a number that are forcibly repatriated after the war of those 300,000 that are rescued. About 100,000 managed to either stay in West Germany or move west. About 30,000 move west to Canada and South America. And 70,000 managed to stay in West Germany. But the other 200,000 are forcibly repatriated. So you end up with about total over a million ethnic Germans forcibly deported. Now, there are Germans who are already living in Kazakhstan and Siberia, and they are put under the same special settlement restrictions as the deportees after the war ends, largely the result of the local NKVD in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan pushing for it. So it's another 100,000 or so people that are there. And if the 100,000 mostly in parts of Siberia and the Urals that are never put under special settlement, there's this conflict in 45 and 46 between the procurator, who's saying that there's no legal basis for local Germans who weren't deported to be put under special settlement restrictions, and the NKVD, particularly in Kazakhstan and Central Asia, doing it anyways. So only about 200 Germans in Kazakhstan out of over 400,000 avoid being placed under special settlement restriction. But in my book, I go through all the numbers. Part of the problem is the Soviets give all different types of listed numbers in the archives. So you end up, there's like a 15% range between these numbers they give, but roughly it's about 750,000 deported and then 700,000 arriving, the other 50,000 mostly dying en route.
Wow, that is nuts. I'm just going to say this, and this is not just from like this conversation, but also based on what I've read on your like Twitter posts on X, Twitter. I'm quite shocked that you don't have like a prominent like academic position for this, because this is what you're doing is Geoman's work, and it's like the highest quality to boot. And I've heard you mention this like in passing, that your work has led you to being like ostracized in certain academic circles. And what was that all about?
It's very complicated. Basically, there's not a lot of interest in what I do. And I upset very powerful people very early on because I wasn't aware just how powerful they were. So my second book, which came out in 1999, Ethnic Cleansing of the USSR, I have in the preface, I note that in her book, Denying the Holocaust, Deborah Lipdyk, 1993, that she denies Soviet ethnic cleansing. She claims no Soviet citizen assumed that deportation and death were inevitable consequences of his or her ethnic origins. And so I said, though, this was, kind of ironic in a book that attacking Holocaust deniers that she denies Soviet genocide. And that basically got me on the shit list of Michael Gelb at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and blacklisted from ever working as a teacher at a U.S. or Canadian university.
Who is Michael Gelb exactly?
Michael Gelb is the editor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies. I think he's one of the big wigs at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. I actually met him in person once. He's a total asshole, but he has a lot of power.
Interesting. And you have not been able to find, even outside of like the U.S. and Canada, you've not been able to find.
Yes, I was able to. I got a job at 3 1-year contracts, American University Central Asia in Kyrgyzstan, which is a Soros Clinton front. And then I got a job at University of Ghana I was still on my first 5-year contract. I could have renewed it, but the currency kept collapsing. So I jumped ship when I was offered a position at American University of Iraq, Sulaymaniyah, in the Kurdish region of Iraq, and that is a CIA front. And I had 1 3-year contract there before it wasn't renewed. But interestingly enough, the only university I worked at that showed any interest or really in support of my research was the University of Ghana. And I think it's largely because the rules and regulations and kind of culture still is still the old British culture from the university founded in 1948. So while there's not that many British left, there was one British professor in my department, and there was a Norwegian as well. A lot of the Ghanaians have kind of kept the Ghanaian professors, obviously, there's a very small group within Ghana, kind of the British academic culture. So they didn't have a lot of resources was the problem. But for non-monetary things, one of the things that happened there, and it was kind of by accident, and I was trying to avoid it, but I was actually very glad it happened, is I got put in charge of the history seminar, which was every week, which meant I had to oversee all the graduate students and honor students' presentations, but also every foreign scholar coming in. We had quite a few from Europe, some from other parts of Africa, occasionally people from the United States. I do remember we had a fair number of people coming from Germany because the eastern part of Ghana had been part of German Togoland before World War I, so they had an interest in studying the German colonial period. And so I ended up with this position by accident because what I said was I didn't want to ask my chairman when it was going to start, that because I knew he would make me in charge of it as a way of saying, well, you wanted to start, you can take care of it. So I asked a fellow professor, and then she then told the chair, Dr. Pohl wants to know when it starts. And so he comes in, Dr. AB tells me you want to know when the seminar is going to start. I said, yes. I said, well, it'll start whenever you organize it because you're in charge of it now. And I was in charge of it for many years. But what I did was try and expand it. So I wanted, and I set the example, I had a couple articles, including the one I did on the deportation of Russian Germans that was published in Russian Review in 2016 that I honed there. I kind of threw it out there as myself to the lion, to the graduate students and professors there to get positive feedback and encouraged the other faculty and particularly graduate students to do so as well, to make the papers publishable in Western journals to get them honed and refined, which was something that was lacking at the time. I think it's gone now too, but I did get a couple of people who did follow and managed to come over to the United States to do their PhDs after completing an MA at Ghana. So it was almost the silver age. The golden age, of course, was from 48 to 66, so the British rule and early independence. But the university itself was part of the University of London all the way until 1961. So from 48 to 61, it was basically still run out of the UK.
Would you say that in the present, your areas of focus are just not really in demand in most universities in the West?
I suppose it would depend what you define as West. I think there is, because I've been had a project, if I can find it. So this book came out of a conference that was organized out of Germany and Austria. I have a chapter on Germans in Kazakhstan. It's called Russian Germans in Four Continents. So because there's so many Beit Aussiedler that have returned, particularly from Kazakhstan to Germany, and they're now a political bloc, particularly within Alternative für Deutschland, there now is some academic interest in Germany about it. But yeah, in the English-speaking world, it's particularly weak. Even though there's over 1 million Americans of German from Russian ancestry and almost as many in Canada, we don't have a lot of academics. There's Eric Schmaltz is at Northwest State, Oklahoma, which is not a major state university. It's in the secondary. But I can't think of any more faculty that we have that haven't retired. Vossler is retired from North Dakota State University. And given our numbers, you know, we were always underrepresented as opposed to other small groups were very much overrepresented.
Would you say that with the proliferation of just like the internet and alternative media in general, that revisionist takes on World War II and just the Soviet Union in general will start to grow in popularity within like a generation or two?
I think so. I think it's happening bit by bit outside. Obviously, the establishment is trying to resist this, but their defenses are at this point so intellectually weak. But I mean, we'll see how it goes when Darryl Cooper's first real episode on enemies comes out, because I think that's the one that's going to cite my book. And maybe some other stuff I've done. So if that happens, I think we'll start to see a greater reinterpretation of World War II. Part of the problem with a big problem with the mythology, right, is that it's not a complete and total lie. That the bits and pieces of truth mixed with bits and pieces of lies into an interpretation that is false, and so you have to like pick out, you know, the false parts, leave the true part, and then there's a whole bunch of truth, the parts that were never put in the narrative that have to be added in there, which may be the most difficult part because there are things that nobody's ever been exposed to on the popular level.
On that thought-provoking note, we'll end here. Thank you so much for coming on to the show, Otto. And before we leave, where can listeners of the show find your work and follow you?
Okay, so for a lot of my academic journals and book chapters, I have an Academia EDU page. I put that in the chat right now. For more recent, shorter pieces, I have a Substack. And I do have a fairly recent piece on the famine of the Volga-German ASSR, which, as I said, it's not just that it was so devastating to the Volga Germans, but it was a huge issue in Germany itself, which I think is largely been forgotten. One, that it happened, but two, that National Socialist activists were, you know, this was like, you know, for them, this was like South Africa was for American leftists in the 80s.
All right, I got the link, and I will share this in the show notes for people to look at.
Thank you for having me on.
No problem. And for the listeners, thank you all for tuning in. And most importantly, don't forget that you can get your free sample PDF of the May-June 2025 issue of the Barnes Review. Some of the articles in the issue include the Communist Misrule in Soviet Kazakhstan by Matthew Raphael Johnson. And also, don't forget to check out our bookstore, which has a collection of close to 400 books, many of which you cannot find anywhere else. And for the Barnes Review History Hour, this is Jose Nino signing out.